Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in French Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Roxane Penchassi. My guests in this episode are Sébastien Philippe and Thomas Tassius, the authors of Toxique, Enquête sur les essais nucléaires français en Polynésie, Toxic, an investigation of French nuclear testing in Polynesia. And that's my English translation of the French title, but as I understand it, an English translation is in the works. The book also has an accompanying website called the Mororoa Files that is available in French and in English with amazing images and documents and all sorts of supplementary materials. And I will be putting the link to that website in the post for this podcast episode. Welcome, Sébastien and Thomas.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Hello.
Oh, I should have said also, the book was published by Presse Universitaire de France in 2021 and Disclose is also part of the publishing project. Is that right, Thomas?
Yeah, exactly. So Disclose is a non-profit media that actually produce the journalistic part, let's say, of the investigation. Mm-hmm. And it was the co-publisher for the book along with Presse Universitaire de France.
So I wonder if we could start by having each one of you just tell our listeners a little bit about yourselves, where you're located, and perhaps the broader scope of the work you do as individuals before collaborating on this project together. Sébastien, do you want to start us out?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a researcher and lecturer at Princeton University. I'm with the Program on Science and Global Security in the School of Public and International Affairs. That's a group of scientists and engineers working at the intersection of science, technology, and policy in Princeton's Policy School. And most of my research really focuses on nuclear weapons issues and issues of technologies and international security.
And Thomas?
I'm a freelance investigative journalist. And I'm based in Paris. Most of my work basically is dedicated to investigative journalism. That's what I do. I usually, and most of my time, worked on migration issues. That's something that I have covered like both in Africa, but also in Europe for the past 8 years. And also working also on defense issues and surveillance.
So the book is focused on the program of French nuclear bomb detonations in what is colonially referred to as French Polynesia. A total of 193 atmospheric and underground after 1975, detonations from 1966 to 1996, so ranging from the Fifth Republic presidencies of De Gaulle to Chirac, and working with a whole team of researchers. So the two of you sort of spearheaded this investigation into the health and environmental impacts of these weapons experiments in the region. And the results are incredible, thank you, and so important to share with a wider readership and public in the ways that you have. So yeah, how did the two of you come together to work on this project?
Yeah, it's a very interesting story. And in fact, it begins with our colleagues, both at Disclose, but at Interpret, which is a group of architects and scholars working on environmental crime and justice issues. And Nabil Ahmed, who's a leading Interpret, was the one who, partly started this project when after a visit in Polynesia to present his work, the work he was doing on other topics in the Pacific, essentially met with a member of civil society there, Bruno Barrio, who's been a long anti-nuclear activist and also kind of has joined the Polynesian government there at some point. But essentially he gave him an archive that civil society had obtained for court battles of French declassified documents.
Mm.
Documents that were declassified in 2013 and had not been really made public nor significantly exploited by researchers. And Nabil, you know, had this archive. Barrio died.
Right.
They wanted to do something together. They couldn't. And Nabil really struggled with and I hope I'll have the opportunity to talk more about the documents and their story and so on. But, you know, the point is they were very technical and very dry.
Mm.
And it took him a while to find someone who both speak, you know, French and could do the technical analysis. And that's how he found me, essentially, because I'm a scientist and engineer by training, and I've also experienced with nuclear weapons. I did work in the French government, so...
You were made for this project.
I was kind of made for this project in part, yes.
Yeah.
And by the time I joined, you know, that's when, you know, I started going through those documents, and Thomas can tell his part of the story, but that's... his colleague at Disclose thought he would be an amazing partner and journalist for this project.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so glad because it clicked so well between us.
Thomas, how did you come into the project?
I think one of the key aspects was to have something at the intersection between like forensic architecture, so to speak, like scholar, you know, having a very rigorous scientific research on those testing, but also having like some journalism down, especially mm-hmm. for to have significant impact on civil society in Polynesia. So my friend and colleagues at Disclose actually at the time approached me with this mass of documents because Sébastien said they're very dry and they are. So imagine for someone who does not have a nuclear background, they are more than dry. They are impossible to understand. And so they say, because I don't know why, to be honest, I'm very like obsessed. So probably, and I love to look at weird old documents. So maybe that's why. And basically the idea was to work something out of this collaboration and something that can work in, so to speak, the three sphere we are working on, journalism, nuclear physics, and also visual art, visual like creation and so on.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty with this investigation is what do you do with this mass of information? Because there's a lot in those documents. So part of the job was to investigate on some of the key aspects, but also investigate how to tell a story that's very old, that has been told, some parts have been told, as Sébastien said, not everything for sure. The funny story is actually Sébastien and I seen each other once.
Once, yeah.
Yeah, once. We worked from a distance for like
the past
2 years. So it's funny, Sébastien is really my love work buddy, right? We call each other like... During the final stage of the books, yeah, probably 10 times a day. So
wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, we wrote a book over the internet, I mean, you know, and on Signal essentially, yes, together.
Without amazing.
Meeting in person.
Wait, so did the collaboration start? It was pre-pandemic, right?
It was in February 2020, so it was 1 month before the pandemic.
Oh.
And at that time, we were supposed to meet in person in the US to have some kind of kickoff meeting, you know?
Yeah.
But poof, pandemic closed. Actually, pandemic was a blessing for me because I had to do a lot of reading. So basically, only days in my room with Sébastien sending me more stuff to read every day. So...
I wonder if we could go back, maybe just for those listeners who aren't as familiar with the French nuclear weapons program and these detonations, first in North Africa, in Algeria, in the Sahara, and then in the Pacific, and just give people, you know, a bit of background to like, what were the French doing blowing up bombs in Polynesia? Like, how did we get to the history that you're and to the story that you all are uncovering aspects of in this project. Sebastian, do you want to kind of give us the quick background to before we get to the project?
Yeah, no, of course. France launched a nuclear weapons program in the 50s. This was a clandestine program for a long time, and it was finally embraced by the French government towards the end of the Fourth Republic, and later, as soon as de Gaulle came back in 58. As part of this program, once it became kind of more recognized internally and developed and mature, the French government decided, and you definitely probably know more that part of the story because I still have to learn what happened in Algeria. But the French government started testing nuclear weapon, and it tested its first nuclear weapon in 1960 in Algeria. So Algeria was still part of the French colonial empire at the time. So, you know, France tested weapons. They're a very crude design at first. Under international pressure, moved its testing in Algeria underground. And at that time, you know, the Algerian War for Independence came to its end. And in the Evian Accord, Algeria gave France the right to continue developing its weapons for a few years, but then essentially asked France to move its nuclear testing ground elsewhere. At that time, France was, you know, seeking to build more powerful nuclear weapons that it had built so far, so-called H-bomb or thermonuclear weapons. So weapons that can unleash energies, you know, 1,000 times more than the bomb that exploded on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, for example. Mm. And I was looking for a test ground where it could do that. And had already kind of surveyed the entirety of its national, let's say, metropolitan territory, but also all the overseas territories. I'd started the survey well before that, but eventually decided that Polynesia was the place to go to move that testing program. Part of this was that the US and the UK had tested in the area. Mm-hmm. So there was kind of experience with, you know, how international community responded to those tests before. Part of it was that the French military in particular and the Atomic Energy Agency, which was, you know, the kind of two key institutions in France who organized the testing. Their point was that, you know, they considered Polynesia as 100 islands and atolls in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. They consider this a pretty much empty place with a low population mm-hmm. density, which of course, you know, wasn't empty. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so decided that this was a place where they could restart atmospheric testing after the rest of the world decided to stop atmospheric testing. Well, when I say the rest of the world, the US, UK, and Russia. Mm-hmm. So France decided to go back there with the idea that if there was too much pushback internationally, they could perhaps find another solution or go underground again. So, you know, addressing this international community concern, but also doing the testing there because the nuclear weapons program at the time didn't have the, you know, the political backup or capital it has today in France. Like, you know, not all citizens really were proponent of that program and thought that it was necessary to continue testing and developing more powerful weapons. And so it was a way of kind of doing this far away from home.
I guess I do. I want to come back to what we've already talked about a little, which are the documents. Because the project did begin with this cache of papers and different types of documents. And yeah, if you could speak, both of you, to, you know, what is the nature of these archives that you are revealing, I guess, in a certain way to people, you know, that hadn't been well known or publicized before? And then what are the other types of materials and sources that came into the project? I mean, everything from visuals to interviews that you conducted on site. Thomas, do you want to start with that?
Yeah, sure. I think it's important to so we say those documents, right? And what the documents actually, so these are 233 documents coming from the French army, basically. Some of them are, you know, at the time of the testing, some of the institutions that were like organizing the test or the collection, for instance, of biological samples to analyze, etc., were partly military, partly also engineer from the Energetic Atomic Committee. So basically, some of the documents come from either one of those two institutions.
Right.
And those documents actually have a history before we use those. It's like there were gained, so to speak, after long legal battles by veteran and by civil society association in Polynesia, which name is Morurua et al. And basically what they did at the time is they asked, after a series of legal challenges, they finally asked for the French state to disclose some of those documents that will help examine for the contamination that some of the military, but also some of the workers at Morua at the time. So Morua was the main testing site. It's an atoll in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. So those documents came from that. And for me, if I speak from my bit of work, the story, because you mentioned additional sources, the story was, the challenge was how to tell those documents. So I looked at first, and I speak to a historian, so I'm sure you will be interesting in that. Maybe have the same way of doing. I open a huge Excel sheet and basically write down every bit of storytelling that I can use, whether it's characters, people named in the documents, places that I can go to, etc., etc. And then what I did is I looked for people that can tell me this story. Military that are in France that I interviewed, probably more than 40 of those. I don't have the exact number in my head.
Oh, yes.
And then I interview also probably more than 20 persons during a field trip to Polynesia, both in the Gambier Island, in Mangareva, which is the main island of this archipelago, and also in Papeete. The documents were the key of our work, right? It was the first material that Sébastien used, and that was the project, actually, to base a lot of our works on those. My job in France was also to kind of see if we can gain other documents, report from the time, to enlighten a bit this first archive. So that was my job, and that was going through sources, through Ingo, the people at Observatoire des Armes, which is a French association in Lyon, that for years actually collect bits and reports and photographs and everything from the French military and the French Polynesian testing at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now I pass the
yeah, pass the mic.
Yes, I was listening to Thomas and I was having, you know, flashback. You know, conversation at the time. So, you know, Thomas said that the documents were declassified as part of court battles, and you know, we had both different ways of, you know, dealing with them. I created this also kind of, I don't know, gigantic network of connecting each document to each other and understanding, trying to have a sense of what had been declassified and what was still classified, and what could be in the document that were partially, you know, declassified, what were documents were missing, and so on. And so this is when we realized that, you know, of course, we had like just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
But it was super interesting, and going through that, you know, what happened to me at some point, I had some knowledge a little bit about the studies that the French government had done on the legacy and the impact of nuclear testing in Polynesia, studies that became the scientific basis for financial compensation in France under the law called the Loi Morin starting in 2010. Mm-hmm. And something that I realized I don't know when exactly, it was kind of towards the beginning, is that those documents were the primary source on which those French government studies had been based.
Mm.
But those studies never cited any of those documents.
Huh.
And so that was an interesting thing, is, you know, and as a scientist and researcher, you know, you can always, you know, it's like pulling references or, you know, starting to do a little bit of peer reviewing work. So I was going back to their calculations of, you know, how they computed the impact on the local populations that were exposed by the fallout from the atmospheric test. And by doing this, I was finding the original data and the original documents. And then as I was going through, then I started realizing, oh, I mean, there were some really amazing assumptions that were made sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, I would find that, you know, there were two data points in the same documents. One was used, the other was not used, and things like this. So it gave a new flavor also to those documents. And I think that speaks to the interdisciplinary, you know, aspect of this project.
Yeah.
The same set of source, we kind of both brought very, really two different ways of looking at them, and crossing this was amazing, because then, you know, Thomas, you know, in our conversation, it could fuel my interest in something, or sometimes like I was telling him, you know, oh, look, this is how CIVA was calculating the impact after this test. And it seems that they must have written another report, and I have no way to, it's not on publicly available, it's not on the internet.
Right.
And as a researcher, there's no way you can do this or have access to it. And as a journalist, was the beauty of working with Thomas was, well, he has access to source and also find sources, and sources sometimes were willing to share documents and information.
Right.
And we got access to those. So it was a way of expanding our ability to understand and shed light on 60 plus years of how the French state had approached the monitoring of the environmental contamination in Polynesia, on the contamination of the biosphere, on how they, you know, try to assess population exposure, and how they used all of us to today decide who is and who is not essentially capable of asking for compensation from the state.
I guess I want to ask, like, how much we can trust the documents, right? So sometimes it seems like what you're uncovering and disclosing is that, you know, that there are these internal contradictions. And then other times, of course, the documents are all we have to know. And one of the things that I find incredibly fascinating is that tension between the underestimation that is built on top of them and whether or not there's also an underestimation of the impact and the harm caused by these bombs and detonations, that whether that's internal to the documents. How do you work with that aspect of it, the sort of truth of them versus the ways in which they might be misleading, and then the reports based on them and other things might also be misleading?
It's a really good question. And there's two ways of, you know, I thought about this. Of course, it was amazing to discover that, you know, the entire, like, let's say, the entire legal system today to compensate victims of nuclear testing in France is based on a paper study, you know, essentially. Mm-hmm. But that's a paper study. But those are documents that clearly explain, you know, well, not all the details of the measurements that were taken, but they are really data rich. I mean, there's like a lot of things in them. And they were stamped secret. They're stamped secret in the sense that they were not meant to be shared, you know. And in fact, Thomas can, you know, to tell more about this also. I mean, he found, you know, when he was reading them also, you know, places where they would say, oh, we cannot, you know, make this public, otherwise we're going to get in trouble, or, you know,
right,
this is going to cause uproar and so on. But the other thing that I've done in this project that was very interesting to me is I reconstructed the fallout from this test, right? Independently. So I, you know, on top of doing this peer reviewing work of the government studies and looking if there were, you know, issues and mistakes in them, or, you know, sometimes validating whatever they were doing, what I've done is I use kind of modern particle atmospheric transport codes that we call them, essentially, you know, using meteorological data sets from how was the weather at the time, and modeling radioactive clouds after an explosion, and looking at where the radioactive particles of the mushroom clouds would go. I kind of draw these maps of the fallouts and compare them to what were the fallouts and, you know, the measurements inside the documents.
Mm.
And they were, you know, for the most part, on the same order of, you know, magnitude, essentially, of the results. So it was a way to kind of cross-validate the data that was in the documents,
right,
with kind of this independent way of reconstructing the test, which was also helpful for us because it also helped us, you know, assess in a few cases that there had been exposure of population in place where the government didn't do and did not carry any measurements.
Mm.
So some population were exposed, we know, very likely because, you know, other places were exposed at the same time. And if you reproduce the trajectory of a cloud, then you find that everybody was exposed, essentially, yeah.
Thomas, do you have thoughts on this truth of the documents question?
I think mainly what we do as journalists and as what we try to do like on a day-to-day basis is actually to go against the mechanism of of public communication, right? That whether it's government agency, military, et cetera, et cetera. And I think for this investigation, what we try to do, and I hope, I'm sure actually that Sébastien agree with me, but I say I hope, is actually we try to flip the narrative, right? We try to flip the narrative on this issue on two main, let's say, lines. And I come back to the data because those two lines are around the data. Mm-hmm. What was the narrative around the French nuclear testing in the Polynesia? It was first that there was not a lot of contamination, that Polynesia was contaminated, sure, like the French states say so, but that the contamination was not so important that we should care about that. Mm. That was the first narrative that was very strong. Then the third one, a third narrative, but I'm not going to go into that because it's above the books. It's about the use of those nuclear bombs at the time and how tactical they were and how useful they were for the French defense. But probably that's a question you're more looking into than myself. And the second narrative that was introducing those nuclear testing as something, you know, very rational, very organized, as, you know, it was squared, like the military were super organized, the testing were organized, everything was super clear, you know, like, and everything worked perfectly fine. And it worked perfectly fine because we're professional, you know, French military has this, as any army, I'm supposed, like, has this narrative of being super, super, like, you know, clear and precise, as a clear shot. And so coming to the data, the first narrative was using their own data, the one they use actually to, as Sébastien said, evaluate the compensation for the victims and use their data. And you said, no, you are wrong. There are stuff in your data that at the time you did that are not scientifically possible. And by saying so, we were able also to open another gate, you know, for the stories was, have the data that you use for compensation all validated. And we discovered they were never validated by anyone because they claimed that international authorities validate the data. And it's wrong. We have the reports. So that was the first narrative that we tried to flip. Mm-hmm. And the second one coming to the, let's say, organization of the testing. So basically the French army said, we have this data, it's a great data. At the time we had top-notch instrument to measure radioactivity and stuff like that. But when you look at the dark, it's not true.
Right.
And so I think that's why those two points seems to be sometimes contradictory. Because of course, if you say that your data you base your study on is not super clear, then what does it say about your study, right? But I think on the contrary, that's why actually the thing toxic had such a great impact in Polynesian society, because you could not escape the criticism, because on either side, there are some criticism that should be made scientifically and also like for civil society.
I just keep thinking about how exciting this must have been as it was happening, you know, this project to be able to, I mean, as terrible as some of the things that you're looking at are that the project itself is, there's a kind of excitement to being able to discover some of these things, but then also to be able to make this impact yourself. So we'll come back to that. I just wanted to follow up on this question of, you know, we've talked about data and documents and all these things, and I want to talk about people now. You know, earlier, I think it was Sébastien, I think you were the one who said, you know, it wasn't empty. Even when I think about the visuals, the most famous visuals, I mean, they're always of the clouds. I mean, licorne always comes to mind. Like, people use it for everything. People even use it to illustrate, like, different tests that weren't Yukon. So like that kind of spectacular clouds are what you see, and you rarely see people depicted in images of these detonations. So let's talk about how many people, you know, people indigenous to the region, and then, you know, the massive influx over time from 1966 to 1996, military personnel, scientific personnel, all the people it takes to set up and to manage the massive infrastructure that these detonations required. So how many people are we talking about? Because I don't think people always understand or know how many people were involved and affected by these so-called tests.
As part of this project, actually, we wanted to know how many people were living on every single of those islands, you know. And Thomas can tell part of the story, but I told him we have to go and get the census data. And there's a whole story of trying to get the census data, going to Polynesia, the Polynesian government's saying, oh, we don't have it, it's in France. The French census saying, we don't have it, it's in Polynesia.
Of course.
And then eventually it is in France, and Thomas, you know, managed to get it. But 100,000 or so people were living at the time of the atmospheric test. So Polynesian kind of local inhabitants. And as the test site infrastructure ramped up, essentially that population doubled. So it would be more or less, you know, 100,000. Wow. Inhabitants, 100,000 kind of civilian and military personnel.
And that sort of, that's a number for the, let's say, the late 1960s that changes, or are you sort of thinking an average over the time of?
Eat
stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Sorry, I keep coming back to the fact that we want to flip the narrative about the French military being organized.
It's good.
Because they do not have actually a clear census. It's not, it's only an estimation. It's difficult to say because about the time at Polynesia, as Sébastien said, we had the census. And that was a clear example of Sébastien asking me to have some sources on the ground. So that was a clear example of interdisciplinary collaboration right there. I think what we got from the public sources that are available is there's roughly 100, I don't remember, I think it's hundreds of thousands of military people on the ground all over the time of the nuclear testing. But that again, you do not have in that number the Polynesian, for instance, worker going mm-hmm. from Papeete to Mururoa for the time of the testings. And that's a population that's complicated also to have an estimation, because most of the companies that were, you know, booming at the time of the test, they do not exist anymore. So it's very difficult to know actually how many people worked. That's actually an issue for the Polynesian government itself.
And so we talk about people, and then when we talk about the impact on people, I mean, a big part of this investigation is the immediate but then longer term health impact on people who are exposed, and then, you know, cross-generational impact of the exposure. So I know it's impossible to summarize that because it's so complicated, but can you give us some of the kind of key things that we should keep in mind in terms of the health impact over time in the region?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so just to give the listeners, you know, an idea, I mean, there are essentially, you know, four pathways to which you become exposed to radioactivity after fallout. two of them considered external exposure. So it's when the fallout brings the radioactive particles over where you are. So you are essentially, the cloud passes over you. Then as the cloud passes over where you are, it's also depositing radioactive particle on the ground, and those stays there and they decay with time. They emit radiation, and those represent a significant portion of the exposure. And the other pathways are what we call internal contamination, where you're breathing the particles when the cloud passes by, but also when you're ingesting food that has been contaminated by the fallout.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where the impact on the workers and the impact on local population is going to differ. There are different, exposure limits for them. They had obviously workers and military and the engineers from the Atomic Energy Agency sometimes had protections. They were, they had means and ways to measure radioactivity in the environment where they were working, which was not the case for the population. But one key issue for the population was, their entire biosphere would get contaminated. All their sources of food
mm-hmm.
would be contaminated, and their water would be contaminated, because one of the primary sources of water, especially in the atolls that were near the test sites, was collecting rainwater.
Right.
And so it happened several times where a radioactive cloud from the test would pass over the island at the same times where rain would start. Mm. And so rain would wash out the cloud in the atmosphere and, essentially collect the radioactive particles, falls down to the roof of the houses, trickle down and get collected into cisterns. And then families would drink that water. The population were in some part... They were not the ones who sometimes did receive the most acute exposure to radiation mm-hmm. in this entire period, but they were the ones who were chronically exposed to radioactivity, radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes in acute manners, after there's at least, the atmospheric tests that took part between 66 and 74, there's really a bunch of them where fallouts were more significant than others. And we found in the document, of course, and one of them was kind of a key example here of what happened. We found, a survey of CEA scientists going to this village on the atoll of Turaya, surveying the family cisterns all over the village and tracking down the name of children who were under 7 years old and in which cistern they were drinking and the amount of contamination in the cistern and how much fission product they are that ingested, how much iodine 131 was a key
mm-hmm.
fission product that fixed on the thyroid and that is a very sensitive organ. And my bottom line here is that there was wide population exposure, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
But really the communities who were perhaps the least protected were the ones who were living closest to the test site.
Right.
And they were exposed the most. Yeah.
This is something that it's a strange feeling to interview people who work on something that I have such an investment in. This is something that I talk about with people sometimes, who say, they were so naive, the French military and state, about the impact of radiation. And that's what accounts for, the negligence, that it was incidental or that they didn't know that radiation could have these harmful effects. So I guess I want one or both of you to respond to that. I'm not saying that, but but to respond to that idea that, especially in the early years of this program, that what accounts for the exposure of the population was just a lack of awareness of the potential harms of radiation from these explosions.
I don't think so, to be honest. Probably Sébastien will have the same answer, but like slightly more precise on the scientific terms.
Mm-hmm.
I think they knew, and I'm sure they knew.
Yeah.
There's in the archive, not in the main archive, but all other documents that we were able to to consult, basically. On the document, you saw that basically the dose limit for the population, for instance, during the talks among, you know, military and doctors, etc., were mainly a political talk. To which dose is it acceptable to expose people? And also, which harm these limits, because in case you reach the limits, right, you have to evacuate the person, you have mm-hmm. to change the pattern of the testing. Which consequences those limits can have on the making of the testings? That mm-hmm. was the way the military thought. I do think so. Mm-hmm. I think they knew for the most part, and I just think they do not care so much. That's the I think that's what you got basically yeah. a lot from the testing. It's not to say that they knew precisely what right. will happen. You know, they could not like assert like. There's going to be, they did not do this very cynical calcul. Like they did not say, look, there's going to be X number of like disease and radio disease, etc. And we can do that because it's acceptable. I think they knew there was some risk for sure. I don't think they can say the contrary. Mm. I don't know what you think, Sebastian.
No, I agree. It's very clear by that time in the 60s that, you know, dangers of ingesting fission products and exposure to radioactive fallout is well known. And in part, you know, the French military does try to avoid, as much as it felt comfortable with, to expose, you know, local population. There's a case of an atoll that was where population were prevented to leave. You know, it was not a settlement that was permanent, but where the local population would come and farm. Or fish, and you know, they prevented them from using and exploiting those resources. So there was knowledge of this. We have to remember that this comes after the US and UK tested in the Pacific, mm-hmm. and after very well known cases of exposure to, you know, populations, whether in the Marshall Islands or even passing by, you know, the fishing vessels and so on. And so they are very well aware of the risk. They are aware even more so because, you know, as I mentioned briefly previously, the US, UK, and Russia accept to stop atmospheric testing. And one of those key reasons was public outcry against what societies started to see as, you know, massive pollutions and exposure of the world populations. Mm-hmm. So they knew, yeah.
And, you know, about your question, there's one quote that I recall from talking to a senior member of a Ministry of Defense cabinet back mm-hmm. in the 90s that was involved in, like, all the discussion with some of the declassification issue, etc. Mm-hmm. He told me, like, you know, it's the absolute weapon. And of course, I state the obvious, right? It's the most powerful weapon you can have. But for those powerful weapons, you have to do some sacrifice. And I think the French state was willing to do so at the time. And this claim that they do not know, it's something that they keep on saying, you know, they do not know that military are sick. But in the book and during the investigation, we had internal emails, actually, from them doing like a survey of how many military people would be sick in the next years, you know. Mm-hmm. So they knew, and they keep on denying that they knew at the time. And that's a pattern that's quite usual, I think, for the military state.
Another thing that I think the project brings together so well is the human impact and the ecological system and seeing that as a whole. And I think that's really a credit to where we are at in some positive ways in terms of thinking holistically about these things. Another of the things that I think is really important about this project is the way that it works against the idea that this is just a historical issue, right? That the test ended in 1996 and that revisiting it, uncovering its lies, I can't think of a better word, so I'll just go with lies, is important, but that this is an ongoing health and environmental problem. And so I guess I wanted you both to speak to that, you know, the fact that the urgency around this project isn't just about revealing what has happened in the past and some of the lingering effects and legacies, but that there's a real risk, especially in terms of the structures, the fragile environmental kind of structures that are housing, containing, you know, with more or less success, what is still there under the surface and then in the surrounding environment. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, of course. And I love that you asked this question. I mean, the book and the work, I mean, it turned out to have such an important impact because it had, you know, political implications on health policy implications and legal implications for people right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I tend to say, you know, going back to this document, for example, where you had a list of children under the age of 7 who ingested for weeks water contaminated with fission products in 1971. They're in their late 40s, early 50s today, and they are developing cancers. I mean, that particular group, but more broadly, people were exposed as children during the atmospheric test are coming to an age where at which you do develop cancer, and you do develop cancers that are recognized under French law as being radiogenic, so and potentially linked to the exposure during this time of testing.
Mm.
And for these people, this is another big issue: the issue of reparation, compensation, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a very concrete part of this, which is being recognized as a victim by the French government and receiving financial compensation. And, you know, what we uncover essentially as part of this work was that the pattern of, and you say lie, and you're absolutely right, because the lies have continued.
Mm-hmm.
The pattern of lies and negligence and secrecy still continue to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And that for a person who would be, you know, be a cancer survivor or a cancer victim in Polynesia, who was living at the time of the test and would apply for compensation, he would sometime get, you know, 1 or 2 page letter back from the French government saying, you know, dear sir, dear madam, we've reviewed your case. Yes, you were there at the right time. And you may have been exposed to fallouts. But, you know, we have calculated that the impact on you specifically is too low. So we essentially cannot give you any money. And our calculations were done by those great scientific institutions. And they were validated by independent group and international experts mandated by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And essentially, there's nothing you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we show that, well, the studies on which those decisions were based underestimated the potential exposures and the dose received by these people. And that not only that, but that idea that all of this had been validated was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we also, you know, as part of the project, interviewed one of the people who was part of this study. And he said, we didn't validate anything, you know, and I kind of fell from my chair at that moment.
Wow.
This is when we kind of realized that, you know, this was really huge and there was a significant impact. And, you know, that kind of pushed us to go through the numbers more holistically. And we found that essentially pretty much the entire, well, at least 90%, if not the entire population of Polynesia had been exposed possibly to a level. So it would not be possible to rule out that they've been received those that today would give them access to compensation should they develop certain kinds of cancers. And that would mean, you know, increasing the number of potential victims by, you know, two orders of magnitudes,
yeah,
increasing the amount of money that the French government would need to pay by two orders of magnitudes. So, you know,
yeah,
almost 700 millions of euros and things like that. So it had like really a huge ramification for today's debate about how do we provide justice for this population and the veterans also.
Yeah. Thomas, did you want to add anything?
I think to understand fully like what we're talking about is like So Polynesia is an outer-sea territory of France. It's very far actually from Paris. Mm. But what one does not realize when reading the French press, and you have to read the Polynesian press to understand that it's still a day-to-day issue in Polynesia. Mm-hmm. Like it's always there, right? Mm-hmm. There's always a case that's been introduced in front of the court. There's always some new development about like the cleaning of some part of the atolls, of like, you know, some veterans, etc., dying, or some association organizing a rally. So it's something that's so rooted in the Polynesian society now, and it has been for years. So when you go there, of course, it's a day-to-day discussion that you can have with people. And this comes also to the fact that it's a small community that's been exposed to radiation, and that in some of the community we visited, like for instance the one in Mangareva, there's a lot of cancer there. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's not our job to assess whether all of those or some of those or part, you know, have been provoked by the nuclear testing. What I can say as a journalist, and what we can say during this investigation, is like, again, we come back to the fact of them knowing there was a note by the health ministry in Polynesia saying that those cancer were likely to be caused by the exposure of the nuclear test. And they called, and I quote, there was cluster of cancer on those islands. So, and that's super important to understand, I think. And when we talk about the victim, and Sebastian mentioned, I think it's important also to remember the veterans. Because when you speak to military personnel that were sent to Mauroa at the time, you face another kind of situation. In France, it's the association for the veteran is called AVEN, mm-hmm. Association des Vétérans pour les Essais Nucléaires, Nuclear Testing Veteran Association. And this association has roughly like 3,000 members, something like that. And there's more than hundreds of thousands military that were sent on Mauroa in Polynesia at this time. And they're facing another stuff. It's like the secret for those military is something they still live day to day. How can you speak about your disease, you know, if you're still, you know, bound to the French military by this secret? You're not supposed to talk about the nuclear testing. You cannot, because at the time you learned that if you do so, you can face disciplinary issues and you can face administrative charges and even legal charges, you know. So the veterans is a totally different situation. Like, they are not so outspoken as the Polynesian are about that. And I think to have those two, you know, set of people in the same book that, of course, face different health issues and different issues. But this was important, I think, for me, mm-hmm. and I think for Seb too, to have it like on the book together, those two categories that sometimes, you know, the French state kind of try to oppose, you know, one into another. So
I was going to ask you both to say more about, you know, the impact that the book has had, you know, the life of this project since it made its debut, the relationship between the book and the website.
Yeah, so, I mean, one thing I want to, you know, briefly go back to as an example is Thomas was very, very modest about this. But, you know, for the French government, you know, said that the tests were clean. And of course that, you know, there was no data whatsoever that could link population exposure to increase level of cancers and so on. And, you know, all of this is so uncertain and whatnot. So he did found that, you know, internal government document in Polynesia was written by a French military doctor, actually, you know, linking those and saying there are clusters of cancers. And this was interesting because we had like kind of broad numbers at the end of the project when all of this came together. So, you know, the book is about to come out. We're finishing up the platform. I'm also writing a scientific article who kind of describes all the, you know, nitty gritty scientific assumptions, reconstruction, data, and whatnot. Mm. So all of it start to come together. And I'm being interviewed by a journalist at Science, you know, the mm-hmm. the magazine. And he says, so how many people and how much is this going to cost? You know, so I'm kind of going back to my numbers and you know, something I never really realized. And this is when, you know, kind of started seeing the scale of it and the potential, I mean, impact on that. But also the fact that we were going to say that everybody knew, even in Polynesia, people knew internally in the government that in France, the government knew. And so, yes, this was about to make some wave. And indeed, I mean, it was seismic. I mean, the book came out. Well, the story almost broke a little bit before by accident. But anyway, it broke on a Tuesday. On the Wednesday, there were already questions asked to the government, you know, in the French parliament. It took 2 weeks for the French government to kind of try to organize a response. We were, you know, everywhere, you know, people were asking, you know, we want to know what happens. MPs threatened parliamentary inquiry and so on. And so it was really, I mean, the political impact was major. And so it kind of started then a political sequence that really is no kind of has come almost to an end, although we'll see if there is a second part of it. But, you know, in June, there were parliamentary questions, a law to expand. Compensation was introduced in parliament, got voted down by the presidential majority. Polynesian delegation was invited to Paris, the office of the prime minister with the Ministry of Defense, Ministry of Health, discussing, you know, what happened and what they would get out of this. Macron decided to go to Polynesia in July of last year. Recognized that the tests had never been clean, that it's impossible that they were to say that they were clean. You know, falling short of apologizing.
Yes.
Although recognizing that, you know, France had a debt towards Polynesia, but which I think was really a legal issue also, because victims of nuclear testing are compensated under a regime of national solidarity, where France doesn't have to recognize its responsibility. And if you do so, that opens another set of legal issues and potential compensation, much broader compensations. So anyway, so that was kind of the sequence coming to his trip to Polynesia, and then also saying that he was going to open all the archives about the French nuclear testing enterprise in Polynesia. And we learn later, and you know, Thomas can tell us more also about this. I mean, this is like an enormous endeavor that is started to kind of cataloging and checking everything. And of course, this is kind of a positive outcome to some extent, but that exercise also has limits because the government is going through every box and removing documents out of them and deciding that no one will ever have the right to see those. So, you know, all of this is still in flux. And so we saw Macron's promises being partially addressed just right before the election, presidential election that just happened. But to this day, it still has kind of fell short of what he has fully promised in terms of access to documents, historical. It's also unclear what will be the legal implications and so on. So, just to say that there was instant impact, and then the long term impact for courts also, we're going to see over the next year or a couple of years.
Wow, that's amazing, Thomas. Did you want to add to that?
Yeah, to come back a bit, what you say, like you must be excited to work on a project like that. But what we came to realize, and I'm sure Sébastien realized that also during the course of the investigation, but was even clearer after release, it is like, of course, a project like that come with excitement, but also with responsibility. It was big accusation we made at the time.
And
we achieved a lot of, you know, I'm very happy with the project and what we've done. And it doesn't happen a lot of time that you can change people's life when you're doing journalism. It's not something that happened every time. It happened every now and then, but it's the project I work on that I think can significantly change the life of like hundreds of persons, hopefully. So there's a legal challenge that Sébastien mentioned. You know, when we published the book, we actually thought like, we knew that we won't change everything. We knew that probably it will have some impact and it has some great impact. But it's also fascinating to see how the system of lie, negligence, and you know that Sébastien described, that was his formula. That's why I'm dropping the formula now, because I know he liked this one. he is very resilient. It's something very fascinating. So and I think the declassification is a good example. So one of the outcome of our investigation was to say, look, now we are going to make everything true. Like, we're going to take all the boxes, put everything on the table, and then we are going to sort this nuclear stuff once and for all. And that was the talks of the Ministry of Outer Sea Territories, Cornu, when he went to Polynesia first. He said, look, okay, now you ask for the truth, we're going to give you the truth. And then when we had a look into the making of who was going to declassify the documents, you know, which are going to be the filter, you know, because for sure, you cannot declassify every document about nuclear testing. It's, and then we came to realize that somehow it's not so different from what happened in the past. So the documents are going to be declassified through some kind of military panel experts that all come from the military, all from the Energy Atomic Committee, so no independent expert. And then they say, look, we're going to be so transparent that the Polynesian will come to the table and say, we want these documents. But of course, they come to the table once, you know, every 3 months, basically, to have a look at what the other have done. And I think that's a good example to prove, like, there's still a lot of stuff to do. There's still a lot of secret to uncover. And I think we did our part. We opened some doors, but there's a lot more doors to be opened. Mm-hmm. So I think for your listener, there's an open, you know, subject at the French archive that's to be looked at, you know.
Well, there are definitely some listeners who are going to take you up on that invitation. Sébastien, Domat, like, I could talk to you for hours about this, but I'm not going to do that to you. And I'm just going to thank you so much for this incredible work that you've both done, and for joining me to talk about it, especially for English listeners, because I think, you know, and in French studies in North America and the UK and like places where people might not be as exposed to this history and to this ongoing set of issues, who are interested in France and interested in, you know, colonialism and interested in nuclear issues. And so I think it just makes the project even more accessible. And I'm going to, as I said earlier, link to the website, which is available in both French and English, which is an amazing resource to accompany the book. And I'm going to look forward to the English translation of the book that when it comes out. So I hope you'll keep me posted about that. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much.